The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
Inflation is a huge factor in terms of what you're getting. Just understand that not only has the majority of the growth in the last century been attributable to inflation, but the majority of the growth since the year 2000 has also been attributable to inflation. The better part of a century's price gains were not organic growth.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, you're finally back. Each year you go to a conference, a meeting of the minds in New York. Pretty famous minds, I should say, like Bill Gross and Peter Singer, John Bogle. And you always come back not only with guests for our show for the next year, but you come back with information that I don't know that I've read elsewhere.
You know, this year was unique in that I took my son. This was his first opportunity to go to this particular conference. Mm-hmm. And he marveled at, you know, listening to some guys who were, you know, worth a couple $1 billion themselves and manage far more than that in the hedge fund world. And of course, his favorite part was not marveling at that. It was marveling at the African animals in the Museum of Natural History.
Right.
He absolutely loves going there. And we found a few minutes to scoot to the Upper West Side and go to the Museum of Natural History.
Well, and you know, it's a lot like what your dad used to do. You know, your dad took you to conferences and meeting of minds, you know, 30 some odd years ago where you were doing the same thing that your son is. I know I was talking to your son, Dave. He's 9 years old, and he is fascinating. I mean, he's been studying Greek and Roman history, and I know you guys went to the Metropolitan Museum and spent a lot of time there.
I remember when I was his age, my dad would give me books that were way beyond my reading level, and there was times that I was just lost in the vocabulary, did not know what was being said because I didn't know the words. And you know, right now he's interested in Greek and Roman history, and the Metropolitan Museum of Art has an amazing exhibit for both Greek and Roman history and artifacts. And so we went there, and I've given him a book and told him if he can read this book, I will give him $20. Now, this is a book that any adult would struggle through simply because it's very detailed history. It's not written for kids, but it's on Spartacus. And he loves the story of the slave rebellion and what was happening at the time and this particular period in Roman history and how it was already sort of past its peak, so to say. And so, you know, it was fun for him to be able to see tangible evidence of this empire which has long been lost.
Yeah. Well, and you're giving him the experience of New York. I know my daughter lived there a couple of years, and, you know, when we go back, it's just a fascinating place. I don't think I would like to live there all the time, to be honest with you. I love living out west, but there's something about the excitement. You know, you've got the subway, you've got the street music, Central Park, you know, and you were there in the spring. Central Park is beautiful in the spring.
To me, the city is almost like a single malt scotch. In small amounts, it lasts me a long, long time, and any more than that would just be wasted on me anyway. So, you know, the subway, the street music, Central Park in spring, it really is, it's a different kind of life than what we have here in Durango, and I'm glad he was able to see that. But also the conference. I mean, the conference itself stretched his mind. I mean, things that, you know, we take for granted.
Well, Dave, you showed me his notepad, okay? I mean, it looks like he was taking notes the whole time. Again, it's 9 years old that we're talking about here. When I was nine, I was not talking about inflation, deflation, currency moves. At 9 years old, I can't imagine he understood everything that they were saying, but the fact is he was interested, he was connected, he was digging in.
I just asked him to write down things that he didn't understand, and so there was lots of little 2 and 3 word things that he would write down. Emerging markets.
Right.
What is an emerging market to a 9-year-old who knows what an emerging market is? So, you know, I drew a map for him of the globe, and he starts saying, Dad, that doesn't look like South America. And I'm like, well, listen, this isn't art class. The point is, let me demonstrate for you the difference between a developed and developing market, the older versus the younger, the emerging that shows promise and has reason perhaps to represent future growth based on demographics, based on commodity sales trends, based on a whole host of things, technological innovation, and just open opened up conversation, I thought to myself, this is really what we're doing right now as a side project with a 40-part series dealing with economics, entrepreneurship, and finance, investment for school-age kids. And, you know, what I try to do at the dinner table with kids who, you know, sometimes they get it, sometimes they don't. But what we try to do on a routine basis is something we've now begun to codify and turn into a curriculum for families to be able to say, yeah, I wish that my kids knew the difference between macro and microeconomics. Yeah. And I don't know that I could explain the time value of money, but I'm glad you have. And, you know, in 7 to 10 minute videos, we're sort of capturing and shrinking the world into something that is, you know, quite frankly, it's going to be above the heads of a 9 or 10 year old, but it'll be perfectly suited for a parent to step in and say, let's talk about this. We want you to have an advantage by the time you're 20 or 30 years old to be so familiar with these concepts that making wise decisions in the world of finance is almost second nature because you've been thinking about this for a long, long time.
Well, and these will be the future leaders who hopefully will guide our economy a little bit better than what's been going on. Now, let's pretend for a second, Dave, I wasn't at your dinner table when you and your son came back, but let's say we were sitting at the dinner table and one of the people at the table says, all right, give me an overview of the conference. I mean, if you had to summarize, before we get into the points, I'd like to hear just what the overview would be.
Yeah, there's quite a few data points that I do want to share, but just in broad brushstrokes, the conclusion of everyone there was that equities are stretched. You know, central banks are committed to their schemes, and it's making value investing almost impossible. It's a rarity today. There is a one-off investment that may or may not make sense in the fullness of time. But that's a theme, is that everyone's recognizing that value is hard to find. Another thing that was sort of a common theme echoed amongst the different speakers was that low duration in fixed income is where you need to be heading. And what I mean by that is if you're looking at intermediate or long-term bonds, you are on the verge of being crucified. And, you know, I mean, on the verge, that's a term that certainly has a near-term urgency to it. But right. The reality is no one knows when. It's just that everyone knows that it will occur. And that was the univocal voice, if you will, of the speakers there, that you want to be in low duration, that is short-term fixed income, if you're going to be in fixed income at all.
Well, and Dave, everyone wants to know when. We know that you don't know when, but on something like the bonds, okay, or something like the equity market, it's a little like having a time bomb in your pocket. You don't know necessarily when it's going to go off if you can't see the numbers on it. But when it does go off, it's devastating enough to maybe decide not to put it in your pocket in the first place.
And I think that's one of the things that was also echoed, is that there's a number of huge directional bets that are worth considering. But again, the timing and the implementation is something that no one's really sure of. So, you know, everyone looks at the equity markets and says, well, you should short them. You just can't short them today. Well, you look at the bond market, you should short it. You just can't short it today. Do you want to own it or do you want to sell it short? There's really ambiguity in terms of what the action is, but everyone understands the context and everyone understands that things are very cattywampus given the commitments that the Fed, the ECB, the Bank of Japan, the Bank of England have made to float the world of assets on a sea of liquidity. So another theme that they had was lowering risk in a portfolio, getting aggressive about that. And what did that look like? Almost without an exception, the asset managers in question were talking about cash allocations of a minimum of 20%. And in one instance, Mitch Cantor, as high as 62.5%.
Right.
You know, the last time Mitch, I sat and had lunch with him, Declan and I had a great conversation with him over lunch. And yeah, he said, the last time I was this high in terms of a cash allocation was 2008, 2009. And I bumped my cash allocation to 50% because I was very uncomfortable with what I saw. And it was very hard to find value. So in the context of not being able to find value, would rather sit in cash. The fact that he's now gone well beyond the 50% mark to having, you know, 2/3 of his assets under management in cash, one, it speaks to the integrity of his clients to appreciate that as a strategic move. And number two, it speaks to the concern, the deep level of concern he has for the imbalances in the economy. And as I say, he's not the only one. There was a range of asset managers who thought, you know, 20%, 30%, up to 62.5% in cash.
Well, I think it's important to point out, Dave, these are men who've made billions of dollars for clients and themselves in equities and in bonds primarily. And these guys are stepping aside and saying, no, thank you. I don't want to play with that much money.
And it's interesting. The guys who are in the hedge fund community seem to have a little bit more flexibility to do that than the guys in the mutual fund world, where being allocated according to your mandate requires almost 100% allocation all the time. Minor divergence from that here and there. So there is a little bit more flexibility with the hedge fund structure, in part because you've got financial lockups. You don't have access to your capital all the time. So they can quote unquote get away with it.
Well, let's go ahead and start with someone who everyone has heard about. Okay, you see him on TV all the time. We know that he's made billions of dollars for himself and others. Bill Gross. What did Bill have to say? Did he kick things off?
You know, very little, actually. He had very little to say. I would say of all the people that I was listening to, I know he's a man of high intelligence. I've enjoyed reading his market commentary for years while he was at PIMCO, and I still enjoy reading it now that he's at Janus. But the reality is he came with something of a cluttered mind. He came with vague ideas, three or four things that he wanted to talk about, and he just kind of rambled about them. Again, I know he's a man of high intelligence, but he was not on his game in this particular context.
Do you think maybe it's because he's pretty much designated the period of time that we're in, the new neutral?
Well, to me, when he suggests the new neutral, what he means by that is sort of a low growth environment where we have so much debt today, it's going to be very difficult to see very much economic growth or to justify very much growth in assets as a result of that. But I would suggest the new nutty instead of the new neutral, because some of the things, the data points that we went through, whether it was with David Einhorn or Peter Singer or David Abrams, John Bogle, Mitch Cantor, the data points that we discussed, again, this is exceptionally strange. And I think as I go through some of these things this morning, you'll see it's out of line with history. I mean, frankly, when you look at huge directional bets and you look at major opportunities to make money, a lot of those come when things are out of line with history. And you have the high probability of mean reversion. In other words, something that's overvalued goes back towards undervaluation. The pendulum swings. And what I mean by mean reversion is getting back to some sort of midpoint of balance or reasonable value.
Right. Let's just talk about growth then, because Bill Gross is calling it a new neutral, low growth environment. I would say it's not just a low growth environment. We're a shrinking environment, because interest rates, I know that was one of the points you came back with, interest rates have been very aggressively lowered, not just in the United States, but worldwide.
Right. A couple of these data points come from a great research piece presented by their chief investment strategist, Michael Hartnett. Since Lehman collapsed, global central banks have cut interest rates 569 times.
Wow.
That's the equivalent of once every three trading days.
That doesn't sound like a healthy, growing environment to me, Dave. You're cutting rates to restart the economies.
It's not normal behavior. Yeah. To have a rate cut here or there to stimulate growth is one thing. But again, on a global basis, central banks all over the planet, 569 times, which is the equivalent of once every three trading days. That would be described as sort of an incubation period. If you wanted to grow hothouse tomatoes, you know what you do? You increase the odds of success by giving more water, giving more nutrients, giving more sunshine, and you keep it in a hothouse so that the tomatoes grow faster and faster and faster. That's what we've tried to do with those 569 rate cuts. Then, you know, nominal GDP growth. Here in the United States, we've had an average growth rate per year since World War II of 6.6%. But for the last 7 years, it has declined to 3.5%. With last year, of course, the first quarter is going to be a little bit disappointing, but last year, 2014, was about 2.4%. So we're even coming in below.
GDP is shrinking, and we're lowering interest rates 569 times.
That's right. So it's no surprise that there's sort of a mismatch. For instance, U.S. equity market capitalization has grown 122% in that same time frame, while GDP in aggregate has grown 18%. Now think about the mismatch there, because the economy is growing in aggregate during that period of time 18% total,
Right.
But the stock market in aggregate, market capitalization up 122.
That sounds like a bubble.
Well, what it means is that for all the monetary mechanisms in place, it's not translating into the real world economy. It's translating into the asset economy, if you will, or the financial economy. Now, you've got central banks on a broader scale, including the United States. Central bank assets have grown to $22.5 trillion. That's greater than the combined economies of the United States and Japan. $22.5 trillion in central bank assets.
They had to go in and buy those assets. Otherwise, those assets would have faced default. In other words, they're going in and intervening.
That creates an artificial price for those assets because they are, in essence, an artificial buyer.
Right.
They're not the normal buyer in terms of markets where you see buyers and sellers in queue. These are extraordinary actions taken to create stabilization, but it's also something that's very difficult to unwind.
Right.
Once a central bank owns $22.5 trillion in assets, is it going to sit on them forever, or is it going to liquidate them? And now
right.
the odds are they're stuck with them, because to liquidate any part of $22 trillion in assets, you are talking about hammering the markets, driving them considerably lower.
Well, and you know, these markets, they're shrinking already. A lot of these interest rates, Dave, that have been lowered, it's not just lowered to zero, they're negative.
Right. And the total is staggering. $4.1 trillion in global debt, which has a negative yield. Negative yield. In other words, you pay to own it versus being paid. You thought that that's the way interest rates worked, was, you know, you give someone a loan, so to say, and they return your principal with interest. In this case, you're paying for the privilege to loan money, which is a little bit odd, but that's the state of affairs. $4.1 trillion in global debt, which has a negative yield, and you've got 52% of all government bonds globally, which yield 1% or less. Then again, if interest rates are an indication of risk, interest rates should be somewhere between 2 and 5%, maybe even 2 and 7%, depending on what country we're talking about. And here we are with half the world's government debt at 1% or less. Something is awry. And there is a correlation, there is a relationship between government bond yields and central bank assets. They have driven those prices down artificially, but it's also created a number of other mismatches we'll talk about.
Well, and you talked about the stock market, but I mean, let's face it, over the years that we're talking about, has it been worth the risk being in the stock market?
I think that comes down to, at least at this juncture, knowing how much longer a bull market could last and how much farther in percentage terms it could run. And in terms of duration and in terms of the total return in this current bull market in equities, you know, the conclusion at the conference was, looking at those numbers, it does not suggest significant upside.
Mm.
And that's a quote. That is a polite way of saying it isn't worth the downside risk to step into the stock market today.
And all of these guys were players back during the tech stock boom. I remember IPOs, these initial public offerings, were the biggest. It didn't matter what the company was back in 98, 99. I mean, it could be a sock puppet company, which there was one. These companies didn't have any profits, but the IPO would skyrocket.
Well, you find that when you get into manic stages in any asset class. So for instance, in the 1970s and 80s, when gold was going from 35 to 875, a 25-fold move, you had companies with the name gold in them. And although they were not in the gold business, in fact, one of them was a bread company.
Yeah.
You had their shares tripling, quadrupling in value because people were buying blindly.
Hmm.
And again, it's an indication of manic behavior. It's an indication of what is ultimately unsustainable, but in the immediate, kind of carries and creates its own momentum. Like in 1999, 80% of current IPOs, that is initial public offerings, are coming to market as unprofitable companies.
Hmm.
So, I mean, again, a parallel between now and the market peak of 99. These are companies that are being represented with a great future, but they're not time-tested, and they're not actually even paying their bills. So what you see with companies like that is they go through rounds of funding, and you know they raise $5 million, gets the company started. But they're not making any money, so they raise $50 million, and they keep the company going a little bit longer and create a new business and bigger, better plan for success into the future. And then they raise $300 million. And then they go public because someday they're going to make money.
Right.
And when they make money, you're going to want to own this company. IPOs of this sort are typically, not always, but typically a way of fleecing the general public of their savings and redirecting capital from entrepreneurs with creative ideas, which don't always work, from savers' assets, which they have worked blood, sweat, and tears to set aside. To me, it's a tragedy, and there's nothing wrong with IPOs, right?
Right.
Kraft came public many years ago, and, you know, here recently was merged with Heinz. And there are reasons to own IPOs.
But let's face it, okay, we do eat macaroni and cheese, and Heinz sells ketchup, okay? They had profits.
You're talking about real products, real profits, yeah, real cash flow, and a repeatable business model. 80% of current IPOs coming out, which are unprofitable. Again, it's a sign of the times.
So we've talked about government bonds. We've talked about equities. Okay, how about corporate bonds? Because corporate bond issuance right now has been very, yep, very high.
And if you look back and compare the 2006 to 2007 period, corporate bond issuance was aggressive then, hitting new highs of $700 billion in that stretch of time. And 28% of that debt was rated a very weak B rating. So the minority of it was B rated. Now you fast forward to 2013 and 14, and we've bested those numbers. You have $1.1 trillion in corporate debt issuance, and 71% of the total is now rated at lowly B status.
Almost three quarters of the debt is B rated or lower?
Yeah, so you've got 50% more debt. Much higher percentage of it is at lower credit quality. This is massively problematic. Of course, you know, a low interest rate environment enables this kind of activity, but it's sowing the seeds for the next and greatest financial crisis. In the same 2006 to 2007 period, you'll recall there was a lightening up of expectations. At one point, you just had to fog a mirror to get a loan.
Right.
Well, 20% of the debt issued in that period of time, 2006 and 2007, was issued what they call covenant light. In other words, with very little skin in the game, with very little ramifications, and with very little call for assets in the case of liquidation. That was then, prior to the crack up of the global financial crisis. Now you've got 60%, which is covenant light.
Wow.
And don't forget that nearly $600 billion of the new debt was used to buy back stock at extremely high prices. To add to that, you've got corporate debt globally, which is growing at about four times the previous rate. So if you looked at sort of 2000 to 2007, at what rate are they accumulating debt? Well, from 2008 to the present, it's increasing at about four times the pace. Is that because interest rates are low and they're doing a smart financial thing to take advantage of low rates? Maybe. But taking on that stock of debt, you have to pay it back at some point.
Right.
And, you know, it's one thing to move it and increase your cash position to be able to grow and expand your business. But to take it and sink it into an asset that has volatility, like your own shares, and to be paying near the all-time highs for those shares, it seems the epitome of foolhardiness.
But, you know, we do have a precedent for debt like this, Dave. We've just passed through a century where there were two devastating wars, World War I, World War II. And you do, in an emergency, you see countries go into debt to the degree I believe that we're seeing right now. Now, we don't have war-like scenarios. What we're seeing right now is just trying to bail out an economy that wants to sink into a depression worldwide. But what would you say about that? I mean, where are we level-wise? This feels like wartime kinds of debt.
Well, that's why I would describe this as nutty.
Yeah.
The new nutty, because this is without global conflagration in the picture. And we have debts in the developed world, the equivalent of what we had in World War I and World War II, relative to GDP in most of your developed economies. And why do I call that nutty? Well, because we needed to borrow the money to finance the war efforts, right? But now we're doing it because we want to, because we can. And that's the kind of, frankly, bad judgment that comes into play when rates are dropped to nothing. The cost of capital, when you lower it to zero, encourages all kinds of nuttiness. And it's no surprise that whether it's corporations or governments, they're all doing the same thing.
It's very ironic, Dave, that we're going into wartime type of debt, and we're actually seeing, we've talked about this before, an increase in what we would consider the war cycle, okay, a return of the war cycle. Yet our armed forces are being dropped to pre-World War II levels. So isn't it strange that we're decreasing our military at the same time that the risks are increasing?
It is axiomatic that when you have weaker global economic growth, that you're going to have increases in tensions and geopolitical risk and conflict. Why is that? Well, again, this is dealing with human nature and the way that politicians deal with social pressures and political pressures. But as you begin to see a deterioration in the economy, there is a series of blame-shifting events which occur, and some of those include looking across the border to your neighbor and saying, well, it's their fault.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the French may blame the Flemish. The Austrians may blame the Germans. The Germans may blame the Spanish. The Italians may blame the Germans. The United States may blame the Canadians or the Mexicans. I mean, there is a blame shifting which occurs, and politicians are only too keen to preserve their own political legacies at the fiscal expense of a nation. And that's tragedy, but it is also human nature. If you see that, very few people take ownership of mistakes that they've made and are certainly willing to kick the can down the road. So you're right. The funny thing is we are at pre-World War II levels in terms of our U.S. armed forces. So at the same time, there's a greater potential for geopolitical conflict. We're shrinking our armed forces considerably.
Well, I'm sure part of the reason for that is the federal budget goes elsewhere, but the federal budget already, I mean, it's huge. You can see why some people would believe that we do need to cut back armed forces.
Right. Well, the problem is you'll find new things to spend it on unnecessarily. I mean, there's never a dollar created the government didn't want to spend. In fact, they'll spend three or four that they don't have, knowing that they can print it or just finance it cheaply. 2015 budget pencils out at $3.7 trillion, and that is government spending, which is greater than the entire German GDP.
Wow.
It's on such a massive scale. You say, well, we could certainly find some things to cut. Sure. You know what? I think that we should have means testing for Social Security. In other words, if I make $150,000 a year, why should I be collecting Social Security? Why?
Right.
If I make $1 million a year, why should I be collecting Social Security? You realize all we're doing is enslaving the next generation, which has a demographic deficit to begin with. There's not enough people working age to support the retiring class. The graying age, if you will, the graying generation, 11,000 people per day moving into retirement. There's a whole bunch of those people that won't like to hear this. But the reality is we have dramatically shifted emphasis. If you think about the number of tax dollars that are spent on an aging generation versus what we spend on a younger generation, even for education, our education budget pales in significance to our Social Security budget. Now, I appreciate Social Security. I appreciate what it represents as a safeguard, as a safety net. But understand that this is a major problem.
Well, and the net has holes in it. Everybody just tries to ignore. They say, well, someday those holes will show up. Well, Dave, I don't want to distract. Let's go back to some of the points that you brought from New York.
Again, it's just an example after example of nuttiness. You know, this is not normal. And we shouldn't accept it as normal. As an investor, you should know that this is not only unprecedented, but unsustainable. In the Bank of England's 300-year history, the base interest rate has never been lower than it is today. And of course, again, connecting the dots, perhaps that relates to London real estate having quadrupled in the last 15 years. You lower rates to zero, and people do what with free money? They go bonkers with it. Now, if we borrow from Rogoff and Reinhardt, history shows that debt defaults start to rise initially, and then that is followed by inflation. And in looking at where we're at in terms of the trends since at least 1900, yes, defaults are expected to rise globally. If you want to look at Venezuela, certainly Russia, Ukraine, there are a half a dozen to a dozen different countries that are moving into high probability of default, maybe even Greece this week, next week, by the end of April. We have these tensions and pressures. And it is typically, according to Reinhardt and Rogoff, symptomatic defaults precede inflation, just as an aside. U.S. equities, another point from the conference. In real terms, that is, when you net out inflation, the U.S. equity markets are still 4% below the peak we put in the year 2000.
That's if you factor in inflation that the government tells you is inflation, which is already understated.
And so what's fascinating is if you go back to 1871, again, this is from Michael Hartnett, going back to 1871, looking at the S&P 500, largest 500 companies in the country, it's had a negative real price return nearly one out of every 2 years. About 50% of the time, you're losing money in real terms, because again, inflation is a huge factor in terms of what you're getting. So people feel like, 18,000 on the Dow, this is fantastic, we're in recovery mode. just understand that not only has the majority of the growth in the last century been attributable to inflation, but the majority of the growth since the year 2000 has also been attributable to inflation. The better part of a century's price gains were not organic growth.
They were actually paying back government debt through inflations. I mean, that's the bottom line. You have an inflation so that your debt becomes cheaper over time. You know, you were talking about the stock market, though, Dave. You're talking about equities, people excited that they've reached 18,000. But the amount of money actually in equities, it's not even reached 2007 levels, has it?
We're right there. In terms of world equity market cap, that is all of your world stock markets combined, $70 trillion is about what you have in global equity markets, which is right about where you were in 2007. Now, it's been a disproportionate gain for the developed world because emerging markets are still roughly 26% below their 2007 levels. And again, the dominant theme has been developed world recovery. That's where our central banks have been printing the most. Now you have, in lockstep with that, a rise in the dollar, which is tightening a noose on emerging market economies as you draw liquidity out of those economies and financial systems into the U.S.
It's intriguing to me, Dave, that we're already at very low interest rates here in the United States, yet the dollar's been continually rising against these other currencies. And ultimately, what that does is that causes great tension in the rest of the world. It can create inflation outside of our own country.
Well, it's a little bit like water displacement. If you take a solid object and push it into a cup of water, what happens to the level of that water? It rises because of the displacement. So when the euro goes down, the dollar goes up. Is that a strength story for the dollar, or is it really commentary on something being depressed in value and naturally creating a buoying effect, if you will, a rising level, just like you would in a liquid? Well, the U.S. 10-year treasury, it hit a 220-year low of 145 basis points. That's 1.45% in July of 2012. Part of the reason why money's coming back to the United States is because you can go elsewhere and pay to have your money with someone else. In other words, if you're in Denmark, you're paying money to sit in Danish bonds. Mm-hmm. You're not receiving money to sit in Danish bonds. Or you can go to a 10-year treasury in the United States and actually make 1.5% to 2%. Believe it or not, as low as our rates are, having hit a low July of a couple of years ago, 220-year low, we still are significantly higher.
Well, and how can Yellen raise rates then? I mean, let's face it, we're lowering rates and the dollar's still going up.
It'll attract a lot of money and it'll end up driving the dollar higher on that basis. But the question is, can she do that? And that remains to be seen.
Well, I guess we could always invest in the Italian bond market. You know, that's just a bastion of safety historically.
Well, goodness gracious. Italian bonds, French bonds, they call the 10-year French bond the oats. And I just imagine this donkey, this ass with his head in a bag. You know, they call it a nose bag. I can't help but think of the ass in a nose bag when I think of French bonds. Sorry. And maybe that's the person who's going to French or Italian bonds today, the ass with their nose in a grain bag. It just doesn't make sense that you would look at Italian 10-year bonds and receive 1.5% because that's what they are today. And assume that that's normal, healthy, or safe. Because, look, it is QE. It's coming from the European Central Bank that drives yields that low. This is, I think, where people are very, very short-term in their thinking. You are not appraising risk. You are looking at yield only. And again, I guess 1.5% is better than zero. But at what risk?
Right.
At what risk? It, literally, in a three-day period, you can walk away from 3 years' worth of income in an Italian bond. The volatility in those kinds of bonds, you have no idea. You assume liquidity. You assume that you can sell. Good luck with that. There are so many times in the marketplace where you have zero liquidity. Well, I mean, again, I could go on and on, just observations that, quite frankly, I found refreshing in the context of some of the smartest money managers in the world. Now, granted, they're managing small pockets of funds. They're not managing things that are generally available to the public. As a qualified institutional investor, sure, a number of these guys manage funds that they closed down years ago because they don't want to raise any more capital. They don't want to manage any more money. Mm-hmm. Why? Because it's difficult to operate in the market effectively if you have a larger and larger footprint. So that's operating with integrity. I appreciate that. Certainly one of the big questions was, how does an era of excess liquidity come to a close? How does an era of excess liquidity come to a close? Because look at this. Everything that we've just been discussing, every one of these data points is at an extreme because of the excess liquidity in this particular era. Well, you can say, okay, well, it's all going to go the other direction. Maybe, but at what political cost? How do you reshape the world in terms of policy and politics and geopolitical relationships in the context of mean reverting? I mean, we're talking about equity markets that in 2008 and 9 went from about 70 trillion to less than 35. Mm-hmm. They got cut in half.
And now we're back up to about 70.
Exactly.
Right.
You can see mean reversion very quickly, very quickly. And what are the consequences? Well, the consequences next go round may be even more severe from a political standpoint. Why? And social standpoint. Why? Because the central banks have already used all their ammunition.
Yeah. Dave, let's put this in context for a second, because, you know, I think back to Declan, your son, when you were Declan's age or just a little bit younger than that. The dollar was worth 1/35 of an ounce of gold. Just in your lifetime, Dave, the dollar has gone to 1/1200th of an ounce of gold.
I think the real critical thing there is that we're talking about the definition of money.
Right.
I mean, we don't define money in terms of gold today, but we always have.
But that's the price of money.
Just as we're talking about extraordinary data points which reflect complete and total imbalance and an unsustainable course. What are we talking about here? The definition of the dollar was 1/20th of an ounce of gold.
Right.
And then in 33, it was devalued to 1/35 by official dictate, 1/35 of an ounce of gold.
Right.
And here we are. Here we are looking at an environment of a managing price stability. We now have a 100-year track record of the Fed doing their job, quote-unquote, managing price stability. And if we define the dollar as it always has been defined up until the 70s,
right,
how are they doing? We're now 1/1200th of an ounce of gold. Talk about a radical devaluation of our currency.
Well, and let's face it, we're on our way at some point to 1/1500th of an ounce of gold, to 1/2000th of an ounce of gold, on and on and on, because they continue to print dollars. And that's the bottom line.
They haven't changed their tune from 1913 forward, but they have ratcheted forward the aggressive nature of their policies and in light of crisis. And we think they've basically created a permanent footprint in the financial market. The Fed and the financial markets are today married. And unless there is some sort of a forced divorce, we have a very different world today.
Something that you focused on in the last few months, actually last year or so, is corporate buybacks of their own shares. This is a way of stimulating the stock price. It's a way of stimulating actually the earnings per share. But it doesn't necessarily show the actual health of the stock market, does it?
No, it doesn't. An interesting Financial Times article this week, we're on target for $1 trillion buybacks and dividends for this year. And it was interesting. An analyst described it this way. A positive description. I quote, "This represents perpetual synthetic growth." Hmm. That's how it was possibly described by one analyst, helping support secondary market demand. Now, what's interesting is in this article, this trend is healthy in their view, and it's supporting demand for equities. But there's another analyst in the same article that says, you know, but if they stop buying back shares, it's not going to have a negative impact. So it'll help you if you're doing it, but it won't hurt you if you're not doing it.
Hmm.
Does this make sense? I mean, this is the kind of talking out of both sides of your mouth. It simply justifies, it's an exploration of how we justify where the stock market is today using any and every means. And yes, it's very clear that buybacks have gotten us here, but it's very disingenuous to imply that the relationship doesn't hold moving the other direction. And it does hold. So we come back, we circle back around to that idea of synthetic growth. What does it imply? That this is the means by which growth is captured. Any thoughts on the real economy? Does that factor in? Retail sales? Credit expansion? Ex-government? Corporations? You know, we've already said that corporate credit expansion was half directed at swapping debt for equity. And what we're talking about here, the buybacks. You know, we don't have real growth. We don't have real growth. We've got interest rates the world over. We mentioned the Dutch at 500-year lows, the British at 300-year lows, the United States at 220-year lows. We couldn't be at 500-year lows, or we would be if we could be, but we're too young a country. You've got to go back to Europe to find new records set at half a millennium Do you think this is odd? Do you think this is unsustainable? Does the pendulum swing the other way? And, you know, just to summarize what we concluded from this conference, whether it was, again, David Einhorn or David Abrams, Bill Gross, John Bogle showed up, Mitch Cantor, Jim Grant. The conclusion was not if, but when, and it's difficult to judge when, but when we are talking about the big kahuna. We're talking about major moves. And is that 6 months from now, 6 days from now, 2 years from now? I think there's a growing number of people who are recognizing it's not different this time. It's going to end as poorly as it's ever ended. Credit expansion, credit excess leads to credit bust. And there are implications for that. So, you know, look, we have the same kind of declining economic statistics, not only in the United States, but in China. Further deterioration of the recent Chinese import and export data. What are the knock-on effects? Canadian dollar, Australian dollar, New Zealand dollar drop lower. They're now at 2009 levels. The last time we saw these currencies at these levels, we were in the worst phase of the global financial crisis. My question is this. Are the commodities markets, are the currency markets already telling us what to expect in terms of market volatility? Meaning, translation, are we on a similar course immediately ahead for the equity and bond markets? And again, how, when? The thing here is, if you're even partially right, you're going to be right as rain. Do you see? The decline in the import and export numbers, they turned China's expected trade surplus from $43.8 billion into a trade surplus of a mere $3 billion.
And that's such a big difference. You know, we talked to Dr. Malmgren last week, and she talked about what she called the perfect circle. Okay, how China was able to grow the way they were because we were buying so much in their goods that they created, and then they would loan us the money back. But that perfect circle is not only being broken in that China is starting to work out other ways of getting paid for things other than the U.S. dollar, but also their growth is slowing. They're not the perfect circle anymore for us, you know, and we've never experienced that. Yours and my adult lifetime, Dave, we have never experienced a slowdown in the engine that was actually fueling our economy.
The chart of the week is Chinese GDP growth expectations set next to the Shanghai Stock Exchange. And Chinese growth expectations, economic growth expectations are sort of in this nasty little downtrend. You know, moving from the left to the bottom, bottom right of the chart. Meanwhile, the Shanghai Stock Exchange is moving parabolically to the upper right-hand corner of the chart. Now, explain to me how this actually makes sense. And I'll tell you, it doesn't. But you get to ignore the implied hard landing. I mean, think of this. The import-export numbers are off. Yes, it tells you something about who the end buyer is and their desire to own Chinese goods. But you're also talking about domestic demand in China, which is also weak in terms of the import numbers. And look at this. Stocks are up in Hong Kong and Shanghai, like 12 to 15% in 1 month. So you have the joys of speculation and leverage and monetary policy gone wild. And that's the reason why you can excuse and ignore what appears to be, again, the implied hard landing from the import-export numbers.
Well, let me ask you a question, okay, because we saw a couple of months ago a very important peg to the euro get broken, okay, the Swiss. It's very expensive to peg your currency to another's currency, and you lose control, frankly, of your own monetary policy. Now, with what's happening with China, are we going to see that peg go away with the currency?
That's an interesting point because, again, you're looking for things that would change the direction of not only one but many markets. And, you know, we've talked about the exchange rate mechanism and what happened in 1992 when George Soros was betting against the British pound. The interesting thing is he was betting against a relationship that couldn't be sustained. Mm-hmm. The Germans wanted to manage their fiscal policies in a certain way and monetary policies in a certain way. And they were tied to the British pound. And so you had an increase in rates in Germany, which didn't match up with the same kinds of policies in Great Britain. Ultimately, two parties at odds separate. And they did. So you look at what we have. Yeah, you're right. Defending the pegs, the Swiss National Bank did it. The Danish now are trying to sustain it. And the question you're assuming that you're asking, that you're suggesting, is with the People's Bank of China. They've been tied to the dollar.
Right.
And it has been in their interest to be tied to the dollar as long as we're the buyer of last resort for every trinket and bauble on the planet. But there is also a cost. The rising value of the dollar, having the RMB, the renminbi, tied to the US dollar means that, yes, they may continue to sell to the United States without losing an advantage, but they are now losing a trade advantage to the rest of the world, whether that be Japan or Europe or everywhere else.
As the dollar rises, their goods are not any more inexpensive than something made here in America.
That's exactly right. So they're compromising their trade competitiveness with the rest of the world by being tied to the US dollar. What are the ramifications of taking that peg away? It's interesting to consider. It's very interesting to consider. As you know, I keep a journal of various trades and investments I've made. Some of the winners, some of the losers, things that over 15, 20 years have made sense and things that have seemed to make sense and in the end didn't. And I like reflecting on my mistakes. It's a good way to learn from them. It adds insight for future decisions. And I'm writing down my assumptions and I'm writing down the variables that were in the economy, the things that I had to go on at the time. And I've looked and said, okay, well, what are the biggest mistakes I've made in recent years?
You know, most money managers won't talk about that. Most money managers are not going to come out and tell you, okay, these are the mistakes that I've made.
Well, I look at the assumptions always. And here's a list of the possibilities of the biggest mistakes I've made. I have assumed that free markets would continue.
Which, especially the last two or three years, we don't see free markets.
Not particularly. But here's the problem with assuming otherwise. You must assume that free markets continue, even if there is a temporary hiatus. We have the extremes of equity market and bond market highs. Yes, they're supported by the lingering central bank emergency measures. Yes, there is a general distortion across asset classes via the control of prices, that is, via our central bank community. So here is that issue of the free markets. Even in the period of the 1940s, where we went to a complete command and control economy, it was temporary in nature. There hasn't been a period of time ever where the free market quit working. Even if you went to communist Russia in the Cold War period, there was still a free market operating. Do you know what they called it? They called it the gray market. They called it the black market. People looked at the system and said, it's just not in our interest to play by the rules because the rules are corrupted and we have to do something to A, survive, B, feed our families, C, move forward in life. And so I look at it as very temporary in nature. Now, could it last 10 years? Could it last 15 years? Could it last 20 years? I don't see the dynamics being even remotely similar to what we had in communist Russia compared to what we have today in a command and control environment. So that it happens is no surprise. That it could be perpetuated without causing concern is very surprising to me. So this notion of free markets and clamping down on them, I am surprised that no one is concerned about it and everyone has moved to treating it as if it's normal. So here's an area where one of my assumptions is temporarily completely wrong.
Right. And Jim Grant, I just read Grant's comments on what you're talking about. How long can they perpetuate it? And he said, really, the policies are being put forward, especially by Yellen right now, as if there'll never, ever be another bump in the road. And he says, once there's a bump in the road, we're going to probably see the return of real pricing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, doesn't that harken back to Mike Tyson's comment? Yeah, we've got a plan. Yellen has a plan. Tyson has a plan. Everybody's got a plan till you get punched in the face.
Right.
And then it's all out the window. Well, another thing that I assumed, so this makes the list of possible mistakes. I assumed that the destabilizing effects of debt, which we experienced in the 2008 to 2009 period, would suggest to investors that adding more debt to the equation would further destabilize global finance and not fix the mess. I assume that people would be looking at this and saying, you know, like being exposed to radiation and getting cancer from it and then voluntarily stepping in line and saying, but I'll take a little more dose to see if I can cure the cancer. It's like, right. Well, maybe in certain areas of medicine that makes sense, but generally applied to the world of finance, you've got a debt problem, more debt doesn't solve it. All it may do, and Bill Gross suggested this at the conference, more debt certainly hasn't fixed the debt problem. Perhaps it's postponed a day of reckoning.
Right.
Nevertheless, you have investors who are today voting with confidence that all is well as they are doing the opposite of what they should be doing. They're extending the maturities of fixed income instruments they're buying. They're increasing duration risk. They're lowering their credit quality to get more income. That's what they need. They need more income. They'll do it at any cost. And in that reach for yield, it goes back to the quote from Rudyard Kipling, the burnt, bandaged finger wobbling back to the flame.
Okay, so the two assumptions that you made that you can look back in the rearview mirror and say, this was a mistake. You assumed that the free market would continue. You assumed that everything that debt had created to create the crisis in 08 and 09 would not be recreated to get us out of the crisis. And obviously, you know, you've talked about it. The debt is so much higher than now. What other assumptions, looking in the rearview mirror, would you say, okay, I would have never known that?
Well, let's look at gold. I came to work with our family business in 2003. I left Wall Street, was working at Morgan Stanley. And a big reason I came back was seeing a major directional change in the price of gold and a major multi-decade change in asset prices and asset values. And looking at that, I assumed that gold would, in this context, today, right now, reflect a no-confidence vote on central banks. And what we've had is they've doubled down on their monetary policies, the very policies which created the global financial crisis. In other words, I came in with an assumption, and it was an assumption about frail fiscal position and a very predictable monetary policy course that was going to be taken. And gold, when I first came into the business and invested heavily in it myself at $300 an ounce, has, even to this day, $1,200 an ounce, done what I thought it would do. Now, it did more than I thought it would do in a shorter period of time, the period of 2010 and 2011. The question is, should I look at that same assumption and undo it or deny its veracity? This is what I'm getting at. If the central banks have doubled down on the same monetary policy that got us into the global financial crisis, what makes us think that the outcome is going to be different this time?
Right.
So the extreme measures taken, they continue to disappoint as growth metrics trickle in. This is still an allocation for me that's focused on future market reaction and a desire for security. The market is today instead ramping up risk. That's what it's doing at present. People are looking for reward without looking at the intrinsic risks in the investments that they're making. To me, what do? I'm still focused on a future reality, on a cause and an effect. And the cause has already been put in place. The effect, it's a question of timing. Now, listen, for 2003 to 2011, right as rain, 2011 to 2015, where's the price of gold gone?
Right.
Nowhere but sideways to down. So again, I look at that and I say, well, okay, has the information changed? If the information's changed, I may need to change course.
But the information hasn't changed.
Lo and behold, the only thing that's happened is in this narrative, you've come along and all you've done is highlighted, underscored, and put an exclamation point behind all the relevant points in the previous narrative. The same things that were done, what brought us to this particular place of instability. Again, all we've done is underscore, highlight, and put an exclamation point by it and say, well, it worked last time until it didn't, so we're going to try it again just with more juice.
So in other words, the factors that took gold from 300 to 1200, those factors have grown exponentially to take gold from 1200 to wherever it's going to go, because we're not talking about gold going anywhere. We're talking about the dollar and the paper markets going down.
Yeah, the consequence of fiscal mismanagement. And then the pressure that's been put on the Fed to make up for it in monetary terms and via monetary policy has put the dollar basically on a death march. Does that happen overnight? Does that happen over a longer period of time? It really depends on how long they can perpetuate confidence. And so to me, I look at the assumption, I'm willing to question it, I'm willing to put it under the microscope and see if it still holds. And it's a potential mistake, but the information hasn't changed.
Right.
The information has not changed.
Well, let's play a game then. Okay, so I'm one of your investors. And I've watched gold just languish, okay, over the last 2 or 3 years. Yes, the information hasn't changed. I get that. But I've watched the people around me making money in the stock market. I've watched people seem to prosper, okay, let's say in British real estate, what have you, okay. These are bubble markets. But what do you do when someone starts to try to pressure you, an investor who says, you know what, I'm really tired of it just sitting here. I'm tired of losing money. Yes, the information has not changed. I've heard this all before. What do you do, Dave?
That's a good question. Well, perhaps the biggest mistake was not assuming these things, which I just mentioned, but assuming the time frame in which there would be an effect from the cause. And we see what's wrong. When will the consequence be felt?
Right.
The nature of a confidence game like the one the European Central Bank, the Fed, the Bank of Japan, the Bank of England, like the game that they're playing, is that a shift from confidence to no confidence happens in an instant. Mm-hmm. Indeed, we have all the ingredients for the next global financial crisis. We only lack a catalyst. Where we are today is in a situation where we're being coerced. We talked with Philippa Malmgren last week about the nature of interest rates playing a role of justice between savers and debtors. And they keep things in balance. But what we have today is coercion in the marketplace. We're being coerced to take more risk for a very thin and ephemeral reward. That's not my idea of a good time. So I continue to opt for cash. I continue to opt for precious metals, and I continue to opt for patience. Mm-hmm. And quite honestly, it seems that the most difficult asset to hold on to today is the last one on the list, patience. Mm. But it is by far the most important. The scale and the scope of these imbalances has my mind racing. There's things that keep me up at night. And as I think about the things that keep me up at night, it's these unresolved relationships. It's these unresolved trends. It's these unsustainable courses. And for anyone who studies history, you know, the market gives, the market takes away. And the market has given all that it can. You know what comes next.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.